Hi, my name is Gunnar Froh and I'm your host on the Wunder Mobility podcast. Okay, welcome back to the Wunder Mobility podcast. Today I'm super happy to be here with Morten Munch Olsen. Welcome.
Good day, good afternoon, I guess. Hello.
I assume you are in Oslo at the moment.
I'm in Norway, right? Yes, enjoying the spring here in the beautiful north.
It's so beautiful, and I have been many times before as a tourist, and at some point, some years ago, I thought that it's a good idea to try and learn a little bit Norwegian, because if ever my company has a project, they have to send me. So that's as far as the passion goes that I had tried to spend some more time there, but so far only as a tourist. It's definitely
so
beautiful.
So how is that going for you?
Ja, jeg snakker litt norsk.
Oh, wow. Ich spreche eigentlich ein Deutsch auch. Ich habe in meinen younger days Motorräder in Deutschland gekauft und importiert zur Norwegen.
Oh, that's really interesting. So you are buying motorcycles in Germany, importing them to Norway?
Yes, as a student. As a student, me and a friend, we did that. We bought them in Germany, drove them home and sold it with a small advance to it.
That's an awesome job because you get the side benefit of the road trip and so on.
Oh, yes,
and
definitely.
Norway is a very interesting mobility country, it seems, from the outside as a visitor, often also in the media, actually, over here. Heard it yesterday on TV, also even mentioned here in Germany when we talk about electrification and transition to EVs and so on. Super high percentage. I think almost all cars that are sold now in Norway are EVs, I believe.
Yeah, I think it's so far this year, it's 98%.
That's crazy.
EVs. So we spend a lot of oil money on the green shift and green mobility shift.
Make other people use your oil and then basically subsidize EVs.
That's the general idea.
But we're mostly here to talk about actually then sharing, not just EVs, because you are also the CEO of Bil Kollektivet. And you say on the website, claim to fame, the largest nonprofit car sharing in Norway. Now, of course, everyone thinks it's because it's the only nonprofit or...
There are two other nonprofits. So, and also we are amongst the largest in total, but we're only operating in Oslo. So in Oslo, we are the biggest in any category of different organizations doing car sharing.
And maybe to give like a feeling for the size, if you want to share like roughly order of magnitude, how many cars are on your fleet at the moment?
Yeah, we have 700 cars in the fleet now.
700 cars of a kind of diverse pool, different cars that also make sense for weekends, I think, and longer trips, bigger cars.
Yeah, we see that our main customer is not driving so much inside of Oslo because there's really good public transport, but they use it for going outside of Oslo and bringing the family and a lot of luggage or doing some big Einkaufen outside of town, something like that. So, so it's not so much city cars, but station wagons. We have SUVs, we have 9-seaters, we have also cargo vans, but not so many cargo vans. It's the majority is what we call personal vehicle,
And on and even some Mazda Miata convertibles.
Yes, so. we have some sports cars for, you know, it's we have a very loyal customer group that's been with us for years and that uses us as their only car service or their only car, actually. That's our main business is from recurring users. And from their perspective or from our perspective, it's whenever they go to a party and they say that, we don't have a car, we use car sharing. And maybe they're met with the prejudice that it's not so cool or whatever. And they can say that, well, you know, if I want the sports car, if I want the convertible, I'll book it and I'll drive it. If I want an SUV, go to the mountain, I'll book it. So I don't know what your station wagon is doing for you, but mine is doing a lot. And now we even have some motorcycles now in the stable. So it's a big range.
going to say this to like round this up, when we imagine your fleet, even like a handful of these expedition, let's say, motorcycles, these cross-country motorcycles, and roofed tents that you can book in addition to the car, right?
Yeah, so this is that's kind of add-ons because it's fun and because we know that our users, they like to go touring, they like to go on adventures. Mm-hmm. So we have those kind of add-on products, but of course the bread and butter for us is still the do-it-all station wagon. We have I think it's 350 Toyota Corollas, and that's mm-hmm. that's perhaps the milk and bread that we have. And
You already touched on your user base a little bit, how it's a very loyal customer base that maybe uses this as their only car. And I would like to talk about this a little bit more because I think it's also tied to what you mentioned in the beginning, like a nonprofit. That's more unusual in the world of vehicle sharing operators. And you have a kind of model where people can use your car like any consumer, but they can also become a member in a cooperative. Can you talk a little bit about how this works? Like, why is the company nonprofit? How many members are there? Is it just a handful of people or most of the heavy users? And why do they, what does it mean? What kind of commitment do they have to make? What benefits do they get?
Yeah, so this company was actually founded by four of the largest environmental groups in Norway. Mm-hmm. And then they decided that this would be an alternative to owning a private car. And this was back in 1995. So we're actually 30 years this year. But then there was only a few people sharing a few cars, and it stayed that way for a long time. And it wasn't until the start of 2010 that it started to get as a commercial service. And I was recruited in 2018. And then there was actually starting to get competition and everything. So I think now we're a competitive and a commercial company, but we still have the roots in the idealistic tradition that we are part of. And so you can, as a user, you can either be a owner. It will cost you the equivalent of 180 euros to mm-hmm. buy a share. You can only buy one share, and mm-hmm. And all share is equally powerful, so to speak. So, mm-hmm. so it's a very broad democratic ownership, and what that gives you is, of course, the ability to have influence on us through the mm-hmm. annual meeting, and you can be in the board if you're elected. Mm-hmm. But also there is an advantage program, so you get some benefits in cheaper insurance, you mm-hmm. can book longer ahead, mm-hmm. and so on. So I think if I remember the numbers correctly, we're about 7,000 owners of the company. mm-hmm. And for recurring users, it's about 15,000. So it's about half.
Is that a big overlap? Yeah, you said it's about half. So basically the members, most of them are also heavy users. It's not like people become a member to support this 20 years ago and now they are still there. Most of these guys are the same as the heavy users. Also, some of the heavy users aren't. But
of course, those who own a share of the company, even though they're not getting any returns on their investment, they're very, very loyal, and they keep choosing us instead of other services. So that's our best customers.
That's a really interesting model. And I think it feels to some extent like an extension of the subscription model, which you also have, I think, right? You can go in by the minute, but you can also commit to a monthly payment, have certain benefits, commit even more. What benefits are you giving then? And then ultimately, if you're a member, you have the most benefits. But like, what dimensions are you using to differentiate there?
Yeah, the most important is the price element. So if you are, we call it click and drive, that's where you have no commitment to us whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Then you get the highest price, you get the list price. Mm-hmm. And then if you pay 150 NOX, which 15 euros mm-hmm. a month, you will get a 10% discount on the prices. Mm-hmm. And then if you are a plus customer, as we call them, then you pay 125 euros and you get a 40% discount. So, of course, it depends how much you're using us. If you drive once every half a year or something, you're well served with the click and drive. But if you use us regularly, it's better to subscribe in some way. And the people who really, really uses us a lot, they are the Plus members, and they benefit from that. Because that used to be one of the biggest objections amongst our users, is that whenever they needed car very often, it was too expensive.
Yeah.
And with that model, it actually takes the edge out of that argument a little bit.
I think this would be interesting to go into a little bit more detail, because maybe most of the people also listening to the podcast are kind of already familiar, maybe from the industry. We know about subscription, of course, then you get a better price. What are some other dimensions that you're also using, the extra benefits that you're getting? So you mentioned before the pre-booking longer in advance. This is interesting. I've not necessarily seen this elsewhere.
I think we're very privileged with that, because already in March we will normally be fully booked for the summer, because we have a good decent order backlog, so to speak, and our customer knows this, that we will be booked early for the summer. And so what you can do in the membership is you can get a longer period of pre-booking, and that's worth quite a lot. So quite a few people know that they will have a long booking in the summer, and they'll upgrade to Plus, because then they can book 4 months ahead. And then they will pay the $12.50 every month until they actually drive. But they will also get 40% discount when they actually drive. So mathematically, it's not so bad. But it's a good situation for us.
I think this is really interesting, because I'm quite sure most car sharing operators, even if they allow pre-booking, don't see bookings this far in advance. And you just mentioned, okay, you're in a good position that in the summer, the fleet is sometimes fully booked. You probably mean, let's say, certain weekends, the most in-demand school holiday weekends, or?
Yeah, so in the summer, we're fully booked from the 1st of July till midst of August. Approximately. So this is a good thing in one sense, but it's also a bad thing, because so why didn't we just double the amount of cars? Because we would go bankrupt in October. So this is also the market being very fluctuant throughout the year, which is not so good. And from our perspective, cars is limited, and the users know that, so they tend to just be early when they know they need it. And for running a sharing business, it's the really sad part is that all the customers, they usually are a flock people, so they do the same things at the same time.
Did you find some ways to smooth out these demand peaks, even the seasonality already? Are there other ways that you can bring usage to these cars in the other month, in the winter time?
Yeah, so the normal or the obvious is trying to attract business usage, because mm-hmm. then you have businesses using the vehicles at the daytime. Mm-hmm. But they have a little bit different needs, so it's not like it's 100% match all the time.
Different need in terms of the locations or the type of car, or why is it not the best match with the offering that you have?
Both. It's the type of cars and also the location, but also the kind of the processes behind it. So mm-hmm. so we are in the core a B2C kind of company, and we know how to work B2C as far as the placement mm-hmm. of the car, the operation of the car. And B2B is a little bit of a different game altogether. There are some... Mm-hmm. Some other things to consider and other demands and other setup maybe in the system as well that they prefer. Mm-hmm. So it's not a very big, we have about close to 400 businesses using us, but they are small businesses, so they're very mm-hmm. much or quite similar to the private usage actually. Mm-hmm. We've had some large contracts as well. But oftentimes it's a little bit difficult for us to handle, because we have our hands full with the normal operation they have different demands, just put it simple.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. I think I can think in different dimensions how it's different. So like processes, maybe software requirements, but also in terms of whole new teams, like maybe a sales team instead of marketing. Maybe there would have to be a salesperson going on.
And also some project management team for implementing and follow-up and that kind of stuff.
Yes. Have you decided for yourself, maybe to the extent that you want to share it, maybe there's a Norwegian competitor listening, but like, do you see that still as a good growth area for the future, or you think it's better to focus on one and become stay really good as a consumer business, but not try to serve these different needs at the same time?
I think it's a huge investment to try to diversify into a market that we are not really good at.
Okay.
So as long as we are able to grow and be profitable, we've been profitable 2 years now and aiming of being that this year as well. As long as we're able to do that and keep growing, I think we will keep having the B2B as a side business kind of, because we don't really, that's the backside of our way of being organized, that we don't really have the big financial muscles to make investments. And we don't have any risk capital. So
what's an evolution in your service in the last years that you are most excited about? Because you've already said the company is now celebrating 30 years. You joined in 2018. It's become more competitive also in Norway. Very sophisticated users. And what's something that has changed in the last years that you are happy with? That's been very successful.
When I started, so even though it's only 2018, it was very old-fashioned because Bilkollektivet was still only selling to the core members, those who were the founding fathers, so to speak.
Yeah.
And they had to write in a notebook in the car how long they had been driving. And if there was something, and then the team here drove out to all the vehicles and collected those notebooks, and they started punching to invoice later. So it was a terrible process, and it was not a very scalable process. So and back then it was about 200 and some cars, so it was quite a few, and they were doing that. And now we need less people serving 700 cars because it's much more efficient. So the journey has been actually to just have modern technology and systems and processes and change the company without throwing the baby out with the water, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So we needed to kind of keep being the non-profit nice guys and the idealistically driven company. Mm-hmm. While we needed to modernize all of the processes. Mm-hmm. That's been a big change. And also we need to be profitable, we need to grow, and to think more commercially within an idealistic company is also a challenge. It's a balance kind of thing.
That's super interesting. I mean, as a potential end user, when I read through your website, now you have this claim, not only the largest up there, but then to say something to the extent of all the revenue gets reinvested in the service, basically, right? So it makes you feel very good as a consumer to know that probably you get good value for money, as long as it's also operated efficiently in the background. And you just mentioned like the huge transition in the last years that must have happened from really like paper-based with 200 vehicles to now it's like automated. When you look to the future, and maybe more also near future, not just like hypothetically in 10 years, what are areas maybe that you feel like they now need to change and be improved, where you feel like, oh, there's still a little bit of maybe waste or of fraud or inefficiency, where you think more should be possible? There's an area for improvement.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. So I think we're doing the basics now. I mean, you can book a car, you can drive it, and it's kind of smooth and easy to do it and hassle free. But I think the expectations will rise, and I think that we need something that will actually make it hurt a little bit if you choose someone else. We need more duct tape to stick the customers to the mast of the company. We have already the subscriptions, which is good, but what if you kind of you know, like the bank services, they will offer you a budget for to use, and they can, and you can check the budget, your actual spendings, and so on. So mm-hmm. if we were able to better contain the mobility need and report about it, and maybe integrate with the calendar to just make it a hassle not to use us, because mm-hmm. we're all integrated in their life, so to speak. Mm-hmm. We need a deeper life integration with the user. Very
interesting.
And if, yeah. and if, I mean, we have a lot of data and not so much knowledge, mm-hmm. because we have data that could tell us who wants which car come Easter. Yes. So yes. we should tell them this car is still available. Be quick mm-hmm. now and book it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's already booked and someone is not finding a car, do you want to be on a wait list? Because we know that we will have cancellations. Maybe you could mm-hmm. just be on a wait list and you could be offered different alternatives all the time. So that kind of things that will even drive our utilization higher and satisfy the customers more. That's what mm-hmm. we need. We need to think more business, like Amazon or the big e-commerce companies. Mm-hmm. We've been thinking too much about bookings and driving and invoicing. Mm-hmm. We need to be done with that. That's uh-huh. just something that needs to work, and we need to mm-hmm. go to the next level.
Those are table stakes kind of automated process, and the next level would be, it sounds like a service that's somehow included more in your life, so it can be more proactive. Maybe yeah. gives you a suggestion that actually makes sense and you only have to say yes or something like that. Confirm. Easter is coming up. We know you had done this and this in the past. So would you, do you want one of these again? Yes, then it's already done. I think that doesn't exist in chat mobility yet.
That's a first mover's advantage for you right there.
Yeah.
We should have a service that said, hey, we looked into your Google Photos and see that you're about to move somewhere. We'll offer you a moving van. Except telling them where we got the information. I'm sure Google is selling that data.
Because then what would this enable for you? Kind of, are you like then basically preempting them from going somewhere else? So there's the need coming up and yes. you already are there before they forget about it or book somewhere
yeah,
else.
Yeah, it's just very, very convenient. We know that convenience is the main driver towards car sharing. It's whenever it's difficult to own your own car because it's parking restrictions and all that kind of stuff, it just needs to be easier. Then we will be chosen.
Mm-hmm. And part of this could be on the like digital side of maybe proactive bookings, maybe for lack of a better word, like suggested yeah. bookings and stuff. What about since you are running a station-based model, correct? It's not a free-floating, it's around stations. Many people in the industry think that this is kind of an ultimate hurdle, like maybe Zipcar, station-based, and then it's for the bigger things, but it's not really for the day-to-day if there's necessarily the walking involved. Why are you convinced to run in the station base versus a free-floating model, first of all, and then why always A to A and not also A to B?
Yeah, I think the customers are, it's proven, so to say, that the customer is not willing to pay for free float.
Ah, why do you say that? That's silly.
It's too expensive to run a free-floating business. And then there is not enough payment, willingness to pay for those costs. At least from what we've seen in Norway and the Nordics, I think, the free-floating cars, they have to be moved a lot by the operators. And they maybe drive two times as much with the operator as with the customer. And that costs a lot. And I think that's the main barrier. And also that because of that situation, you have to limit the area where they can actually drive, so you don't get it dropped somewhere in the north of Norway or something. And also finally, because of pre-bookings, because that's so important for us. People going to the cabins in the weekend, they book it on Tuesday or Monday, and they drive on Friday to Sunday. So that's also a little bit different. But there is no, it's just practicality. We're agnostic what kind of model. I don't want to have the cars on stations if there is a better way. And I mean, ideally, maybe in the near future, we could have the car pick up the user. That would be great.
Yes.
And return to the spot by themselves or maybe even remotely. That's something that, I think I would be very interested to start experiencing with as a pilot, to have remotely operated cars, maybe something in between remotely operated and also self-driving that mm-hmm. could go to virtual stations or go to the user, so that we could have all the cars in one place and for service and charging, which is a pain, to be honest. And then when the user books it, we could just drive it to somewhere they could easily pick it up. That's mm-hmm. I think that's operationally and except from the what we talked about with the app and the system, I think that's the big change that we will see it. I think that's closer than the ultimate self-driven car. I think most people will still like to drive their cars, mm-hmm. but they would love for it to come pick them up. Mm-hmm. So there is something there that we need to invest some time in and try to figure out. I'll ask maybe if someone will use some oil money to sponsor us and try and have a look on that.
Since it's Norway, maybe there's somebody with oil money. I totally think that as well. I think that it feels like shared mobility went through like a lot of disruption in the last years where things seem to be shaken up and now it's moving a little bit more, seems towards a kind of equilibrium. Okay, so we know there's the ride-hailing battles, the vehicle sharing, and it's getting a little bit more sane, you know, more sometimes regional operators are approaching break-even. You mentioned already 2 years now. You guys are break-even, for example, some region. But then it will all get into kind of disarray again soon we can actually move the cars around. Or the first people can and others can't. It's a really superior product experience. And all of a sudden, the border between car sharing and ride-hailing becomes blurry again with all the consequences, the questions that it raises in terms of regulation and competition. And I think it's super fascinating. Some days ago, I think it was published about the numbers from Waymo in San Francisco, and you can see how they surpassed Lyft already now and are on a track, maybe in a few months, more rides than Uber. So it's definitely come out of the pilot phase into like a big commercial rollout, and then think expected. It's already, you never know with Tesla because they make announcements, gets postponed forever. But supposedly, still this month, the launch of their autonomous ride hailing service, Moya from Hamburg, has autonomous shuttles driving around in Hamburg now, a mix of mostly driver fleets, but also some autonomous ID buses. And and then these remote controlled, like I said, teleoperations, not even necessarily an amazing autonomous vehicle, but kind of enhanced to teleoperations that they can be moved around. And we saw this with Poppy in Brussels, I think the first car sharing operator now in Europe to relocate some of their cars to come to the user. And that's really, really a game changer in the experience of the end user, the value of the product. And maybe the economics of the operator, because you need a smaller fleet for the same service level now.
Yes, and the parking in the city is a burden for us as well, not only the private people. And getting the car out of the center is politically the most of the objective in this. And if we could not only prevent people from having their own car in the city center, we could also prevent having our cars in the city center, then it's a win-win.
In Hamburg, where they are, I would say like maybe quite innovative with mobility topics, and even the senator for mobility, the office was renamed to be called Senator for the Transformation of Mobility, you know, the transition to sustainable mobility kind of. Mm-hmm. And then they are talking about, okay, we want to probably limit or make it illegal that cars can be self-driving in the city. You know, so that's the other thing. They are then worried maybe there will be more traffic than before because people send their car home to avoid the parking fee and come back later to pick them up.
Yes, I think that's a legitimate worry, I think, because you will use your car as a very cheap getting your food pack kind of thing. So it will be a lot of... Now it's already a problem that cars are only driven with one person on board. And if then it's less than one person in average, then there will be even bigger problems. So, but the good regulation for this is to limit self-driving to operators like us and to shared vehicles. That's I think that's a low-hanging fruit in that sense, because I think many will think that we can't have self-driving empty cars around the streets all the time. That's not a good solution.
What you have as a kind of operating model, where it's a cooperative with members, and then you have some loyalty through this, and you have this value proposition, it all gets reinvested into the product. Do you think that's only possible if it's set up like this from the beginning, or do you know of any examples where a company was transformed into from a for-profit into like a cooperative later?
Well, ultimately, I think it's the values that are important, and what values you talk about and what you reflect as a company. So the actual ownership, I'm not so sure. It just makes it a little bit easier, because at least for our users in Norway, we know that they are the typical user is well educated and has a good job, public sector or culturally orientated, and they're kind of idealistic. So being a non-profit and kind of giving the environmental flag a lot is considered very good, and it's easy for them to connect with. But I think you can do that as a privately owned company. You just have to make sure that you walk the talk, and it's not only empty words on a PowerPoint or marketing banner somewhere.
It's interesting. So you have a quite pragmatic approach both to how it's more about the values, the actual actions being consistent, ownership.
Yeah.
It could be maybe in different ownership, but also the other way around, where you're saying we are a non-profit, but we have to be commercially minded now. We have to also grow, for example, because there's competition, so to have a good offering. What is something that you think will change if we look to the future, and look at the industry right now? So with these different vehicle types, different players that are currently in the market, do you think in a few years it's going to look more or less the same, or are there certain modes or certain products that you think will disappear or become much bigger than today?
Well, I certainly hope and maybe also think that there will be more flexible vehicles that are more designed for multi-purpose. So now we're buying the same cars as everyone else. But actually we would also need the cars that were suited for sharing, that had an easier user interface, and maybe also a flexible system within from carrying cargo to carrying passengers. And there are some cars getting close to that, perhaps, and that's interesting to look into.
Do you have an example in mind?
No, really, but I think some of the Toyota Proace that can have a 9-seat or an 8-seat or a cargo van that has all of the right ingredients to do that, or similar cars like that. The downside of it is that it's really expensive. So if you are at the end of the day just moving yourself and your wife or girlfriend, it's too expensive. So there's something there that also for us, it's beneficial to have as few as possible different models, car models, while at the same time hitting or answering to the needs of different users. So if there was some kind of flexibility within that, it would be beneficial for us.
Made me think of something like a Zoox right now when you said that, where they have these box-like cars. You can't even tell where's the front, where's the back.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of like more from the autonomous shuttle area. But yeah, it's maybe the volumes are just too small still for any OEM to really have more sharing oriented vehicles, I think.
Yes, and then on the other side, our users also are a bit conservative. They like to drive a proper car, so they will still book an SUV and be very happy about it. So it may be a slow change, because there are all kinds of elements inside of that. But as a niche product, I think it would be good.
Nice. Cool. Wow. That's really a lot. I think we covered a lot of ground. So long tradition, long history, 30 years old, but in the last years, accelerating more and more, full tech transformation. now a competitive environment, and then you're looking ahead to where this could be going, maybe teleoperated, even autonomous vehicles in the fleet. The main sort of what you're trying to get to, it seems like now, is to kind of put the table stakes behind you and find ways to have more stickiness in a way. You said this duct tape your users kind of to the service more.
It works with everything.
And to somehow be more involved in their life, to be there before they maybe forget about it or consider other options. And how can that look like right now? I think that you're quite, maybe let's say, more on the forefront there as an operator. I think most people in the industry at the moment are still like trying to reach this point of profitability and really like also ironing out some of the processes to actually have cost savings or at least reach profitability. But it sounds like, if I get it correctly, what you are mostly focused on right now then is the revenue side. Not the cost side, right?
Yes, but that's just because we're really, really good at keeping the costs down.
Mm-hmm. So it's always been good. That's why
we have a good machine. We are good at operating. So the revenues then we can focus on the revenue side and keep growing. But it's always there. I mean, operating cars are expensive, and it's very easy to take the other way. It's difficult to scale. Because whenever you get one more car, you get one more trouble. And you get one more trouble you have to handle. So doing that in a sense to minimize the extra burden, that's a good thing. So utilization and the operability, fewer user interfaces, fewer different models, more closer together, bigger hubs, all of that kind of things that keeps the costs down, and then we can focus on the revenue.
One final question, if it's okay for you. We didn't discuss this before, so it's a little bit like out of the blue, but if you would launch like a new business somehow in mobility now this year, what do you think it might be? What's a topic that you think is interesting to start now that's not done yet enough?
Well, I already started motorcycle sharing this
okay.
this season, and we're also looking into with partners to go into a little bit of adventure touring, both with the mm-hmm. motorcycles and also with the SUVs, mm-hmm. to kind of just add value. But it's not like a big business idea. It's more like the marketing budget. I think that's maybe the little spice on top of the operation right now.
What this reminds me of is, so you're going into the experiences business, yes. Basically, right? It's not like, here's a car that can carry 5 people and 3 suitcases, but you're selling an adventure, a unique thing, maybe a lifestyle. And it's quite interesting that often it seems like there's this gap between vehicle sales is for most consumers very emotionalized. Like they're paying more than is rational for a certain brand, for certain features, extra colors or whatever. But then in shared mobility, it's all about price. It's like, who have to be close to me and who has the cheapest rate. And then we have low margins. And we don't really manage to bring some of this emotional or lifestyle aspect from buying a car into also sharing a car. And maybe with like an adventure side on top, whether it's actually the adventure or I'm going with a company who stands for adventure and outdoor in a certain lifestyle. That's really interesting.
It can be both. And I think that's a very good observation. We are very good at telling the users how expensive it is at all times. So that's also kind of a code to crack, how to kind of not telling them it's expensive, maybe telling them it's worth it or something. Yeah. It's better than the alternative.
Good idea. Maybe after the podcast or next year, then we'll see in some other parts of Europe also a little bit more adventure and a little bit more branding. Super. Thanks a lot for taking the time today, Morten. So nice chatting with you.
You too.
All the best.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.